WCHD 3 Detroit, KMPS HD 3 Seattle, WBMX HD 3 Boston,
and on AOL Radio
and Yahoo Launchcast.
CBS Radio's The New Sky.
New horizons.
No boundaries.
Welcome to Hot Leads and Cold Cases with Nancy DuTetra.
Oh, mama, I can hear you a-crying. You're so scared and all alone. Hangman is coming down from the gallows.
Call Nancy DuTetra now.
248-545-SOUL.
And welcome in, everyone. New Sky Radio and the Para-X Network. It is Hot Leads Cold Cases, and we're very excited about tonight's show. Now, of course, each week here we bring you a new and fascinating guest, and this week is no exception. We will let Nancy get into that in just a moment. If you have any questions or comments for the show tonight, 248-545-7685, 248-545-SOUL. Also, instant feedback at newskyradio.com. And, of course, the Para-X chat room is another way to chime in throughout the show tonight. Remember, find Nancy away from the show at theskepticalpsychic.com. So we'll find out what's in store for us tonight, and we'll send it over to your host, Nancy DuTerre.
All right. Thank you very much, Brandon. Welcome, everyone. I have a very special guest with me this evening. He is the sixth man to walk on the moon. Dr. Edgar Mitchell belongs to a very unique and special club of only 12 men, probably some version of either Christ's Disciples or the Dirty Dozen, don't know which, and they've all walked on the moon. Actually, this all happened in a total of only six trips to the moon in a brief three-year period of time between 1969 and 1972. Dr. Mitchell's trip to the moon occurred in the winter of 1972. He stayed on the moon, I believe, for 2 days. It was NASA's third manned lunar landing, and the total trip lasted 9 days. The Apollo 14 mission was also the first mission devoted exclusively to the gathering of scientific data. Dr. Mitchell was, in many ways, the perfect candidate for the job. He's a scientist, test pilot, naval officer, astronaut, and entrepreneur. He was a test pilot for the Navy and a fighter pilot in combat during the Korean War. He got his degree in industrial management from Carnegie Mellon University, then received a master's degree in aeronautical engineering at the U.S. Naval Postgraduate School, and a doctorate in aeronautics from MIT. He's a recipient of medals and honors too numerous to mention here, but I will mention a couple. He received the Presidential Medal of Freedom, and he was a nominee for the Nobel Peace Prize. The year after his moon landing, Dr. Mitchell retired from the Navy and founded the Institute of Noetic Sciences to sponsor research into the scientific origins of consciousness. He's the author of two books, Psychic Exploration and The Way of the Explorer. I believe he is still the only astronaut to have spoken out publicly about his belief in UFOs, extraterrestrials, and a related government cover-up. Dr. Mitchell grew up near Roswell, New Mexico, and was a high school senior in 1947 at the time of the famous UFO crash in Roswell. So welcome to the show, Dr. Mitchell.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you today, Nancy.
Let me ask you, just before we start, just because it's sort of timely, but, you know, this week the federal government shut down because Congress failed to submit its budget. And I think a lot of people don't realize that we've currently got American astronauts living in the International Space Station. And since NASA's part of the federal government, 18,000 of its employees have been furloughed while the agency is basically shut down. So there's only a small crew that's still working at mission control. Do you find that a little spooky for our astronauts?
Yes, it's a little difficult. We're going to have to get past that fairly quickly. They have a limited time up there before they really need some new supplies and some attention. So we've got to get past that one.
How long do you think this can go on before it gets to be problematic for them?
Well, I am not that familiar with the details of how they manage their supplies there and their resupplies, so I can't really address that with personal knowledge. You have to talk to one of the shuttle astronauts that and more familiar with it than I am to get that answer.
Okay. Let me take you back to 1998. You were quoted on the Coast to Coast radio show with Art Bell saying that you believed representative democracy might be in danger. What did you mean by that?
Well, I don't remember what that particular program, but what we're really facing right now on planet Earth is a sustainability issue with the growth of exponential growth of population from about 1.9 billion at the beginning of the 20th century to over 7 billion now and headed for 9 billion in this century, and the attendant consumption of non-renewable resources. So we have to start really thinking very much about how we keep our civilization going under these conditions.
I agree with you, and I'm actually horrified by it because I know that during my lifetime it's doubled, and I feel like I'm running out of elbow space.
I think that is true for all of us. That's exactly the point, that we have to learn to manage our population and manage our consumption and learn to start working towards serving the greater good, managing the sustainability problem, or simply we're going to cease to exist here in due course.
Do you think that anybody anywhere on this planet is working towards some type of an off-planet existence for the human race?
Oh, yes. There are quite a few people working in the area of hoping to get colonies on Mars. I personally am very interested in the problem of zero-point energy, which would seem to be what our ET visitors use to get here and get off of here, because they have to have craft that move them in great distances and faster than we're able to move them with far less energy expenditure. And that's a technology that we do not have right now. It's even a science we don't have, and we need it very badly. Some of us are working on it and have been for quite some time.
Let me jump the gun just a little bit. I have interviewed people on this program who have told me that they have time traveled to Mars or have done things like that. Have you heard anything about that? Does that seem like it's within the realm of possibility?
I will not speak to that because there are a lot of people working on that issue. I frankly have not seen anything that to me is credible research that tells us we can time travel. Now, time is a local measure, by the way, but what we're talking about here is being able to get craft to the speed of light, because then the question of the physics of it and the mathematics of it become a little questionable, and I do not feel that I am up to speed on that enough to discuss it on a one-to-one basis.
What about the so-called Montauk chair? The Montauk chair. Have you heard of that?
I have heard of it. I'm not familiar enough to be able to discuss it.
Okay. Well, all right. Let me take you back to some questions that I had for you, because I know you've been a very strong advocate for disclosure about the UFO phenomena. And you have been a witness in a number of different programs and initiatives that have taken place. And I guess I'm curious, because you've come out so strongly in favor of a belief system in UFOs and ETs, you say you've never seen any. And you say that during your 240,000-mile flight to and from the moon, you didn't see any. There weren't any. They weren't trailing your craft. You didn't see them on the moon. You didn't see artificial structures on the moon. Is that all correct? I mean, what is the basis of your belief?
That's all correct. I have become a student of the UFO alien visitation issue, but I have not had firsthand personal experience except my Roswell upbringing and my interconnection with the people there in the 1947 issue that I got to know quite well. But also I have become over the last several years quite well known to and known of all of the real prominent investigators of UFOs and alien visitation in Europe, the United States, South America, Mexico. In other words, all of the foreign countries that have been more open about this than our country has. And these people that have been long-term investigators are very credible scientists, and they have very good evidence. And as a matter of fact, if you want to go back in our history, for example, there's a picture of a UFO on one of Michelangelo's paintings that goes back several hundred years. There is a reference in our biblical history of chariots of fire in the sky. There's quite a lot of inferences, but we don't have a lot of good, solid evidence except for the very few, very competent investigators, like Dick Pope in England, for example, and others of his ilk who have been investigating these things for a long, long time.
All right, we got to take a quick break. Everybody stay with us. You're listening to Hot Leads Cold Cases. My guest tonight is Dr. Edgar Mitchell.
Enlighten, empower, enrich. This is CBS Radio's The New Sky. New horizons, no boundaries.
It's been 7 hours and 15 days since you took your love away. I go out every night and sleep all day since you took your love away. Since you've been gone, I can do whatever I want. I can see whomever I choose. I can eat my dinner in a fancy restaurant, but nothing, I said nothing can take away.
CBS Radio's The New Sky. New horizons, no boundaries.
Back to Hot Leads and Cold Cases with Nancy Duterte.
You're hot and you're cold. You're yes and you're no. You're in and you're out. You're up and you're down.
Call Nancy Duterte now.
248-545-SOUL.
Welcome back, everybody. You're listening to Hot Leads, Cold Cases. My guest tonight is Dr. Edgar Mitchell. So you were explaining, Dr. Mitchell, before the break that you haven't actually seen a UFO, or you haven't actually seen extraterrestrials. There are many people in government now who are saying they've seen both.
Yes, that is quite true. And perhaps some of the most spectacular ones were the so-called Phoenix Lights event of several years ago.
Right.
Which a very large craft flew low over Phoenix. I happened to have been on the telephone at that particular period with a friend out at one of the laboratories in Phoenix. So I got a first-hand report, although I wasn't personally there, of the event. And also my Roswell experience, I grew up there. And after I went to the moon and came back and talked to some of the people, they wanted to tell me all of their experiences because they'd been hushed up also. Also, as a military officer during the Korean War and thereafter, many pilots were reporting encounters. But whenever we reported that to our authorities, they were suddenly investigated and told to hush up about it. And so people, military officers just quit reporting what they were discovering with that sort of thing, of flight officers, because they were tired of being hassled by the authorities that said, hush up about this.
It seems like, because, you know, that's a story you hear over and over again about people, particularly in the military or pilots, being told that they can't release that information. It almost seems like whoever is in control of this information has almost, you know, it's like there's several, like a several-headed monster. They seem to have tentacles into every place and everywhere. And how is it that some organization could have that much access and that much information and yet remain so secret?
Well, I only can tell you my personal opinion and what I think is common opinion among those of us who are somewhat peripheral to all of this, is the fact that it's not any one control that we're talking about. I refer to it, and it is referred to as a cabal, that is controlled by certain, perhaps very wealthy and well-connected people world over. And their game in all of this is hopefully they will have total control of a new technology that in the future will be immensely profitable and immensely powerful in managing world civilization. It's just my guess would be that it's taking free enterprise to its ultimate limit of control. And maybe that's not true, but the likelihood, all the evidence points to it being true.
You don't find it? I mean, I personally know a lot of wealthy people around the world. I know a lot of people in an awful lot of places. And for some reason, I don't seem to have bumped into anybody who seems to have met these people. Isn't that peculiar?
Well, it's peculiar, but if you take a look in the United States at the moment about much of the money behind the political parties, and particularly the so-called Tea Party at this point, there's some nefarious work going on there that's not in the public interest at all. And for those of us interested in really the public welfare and what's best in the public interest, you would not consider all of this type of activity as being in the service to the greater good.
Hmm. Well, let me ask you, back in 2001, Dr. Stephen Greer launched his disclosure project at the National Press Club. And he's sort of become a bit of a controversial rock star in the UFO field over the last couple of decades. And you were listed as a witness in the program, and apparently that rubbed you the wrong way. And you were quoted in a newspaper article saying, quote, "I cooperated with Steve Greer some years ago, but he began to overreach his data continuously, necessitating withdrawal by myself and I believe several others," unquote. And given the fact that you and he seem to be, at least, you know, on the surface, on the same side of the UFO argument, how has he, in your opinion, either inflated or corrupted UFO information. And do you believe that that's damaging to a field that's already kind of rife with disinformation and disbelief?
I really prefer not to speak to any criticism of Steve Greer. I did work with him very closely at one time in the past. At the moment, I'm far more closely with Steve Bassett. Mm-hmm. I mean, Bassett at Paradigm Church Group. Mm-hmm. And I do follow what Greer's doing, and we did go to the Pentagon together quite a few years ago and told our story and got some results out of that. But we didn't get any new information that we didn't know. We seemed to be talking to people who knew less than we did. And so let's go on past and not discuss Greer, because we're not in the best terms here, frankly.
Okay, no problem. Well, let me ask you, there was a situation where, and this also is public information now because you've talked about it, where you and he went and met with Admiral Wilson, Thomas Wilson.
Yes.
And tried to persuade
That's
him.
That's what I'm talking about. We went to the Pentagon. Yes, that is true.
Yeah. He later denied the whole story. Why do you think he denied it?
Well, for the same reason a lot of these things seem to be very controversial. People are told to shut up and not talk about it by people that they're in a chain of authority under. And I'm sure that happened with the Admiral also.
But he was a director of the DIA, Defense Intelligence Agency. How is it that somebody that high up can get that intimidated?
You tell me. I can't answer that question. I'm sorry. That's we've seen this sort of thing happen over and over. And I'll point out to you, when Barry Goldwater was running for president, and he asked the head, and I'm blocking on his name right now, head of Strategic Air Command about these things and was told to hush up about it and don't talk about it. Bill Clinton, when he was president, sent an emissary to Wright-Patterson Air Force Base who was told that he did not have a need to know and therefore he couldn't learn anything from that. So you see there's a whole lot of strange things going on here that those of us that are very remote or even some that are not so remote from the top of the chain can't get the answers you're looking for.
Yeah, and I was going to ask you about that because I've certainly heard all of the stories about at least the past three presidents, I believe, who or maybe four, who have asked for the UFO information, been denied. And I find the fact that that has not been made a significant story in the media is extraordinary to me.
Well, there's just several things extraordinary in this whole area. And I certainly don't have the answers to it. I'd be glad to talk about it if I did, but I don't.
Okay. All right. Let's talk about a little bit about also the citizens hearing on disclosure. You mentioned that you're working with Steve Bassett now, and he actually announced on this program not that long ago that he intended to go forward with a basically a program to try and persuade Congress at this point to hold full hearings on the UFO disclosure matter.
That is correct.
And I assume that you're behind him on that and that if you were asked to testify, you would do that.
Well, I did testify. Well, when he had the public meeting here months ago now,
right.
I did testify at that. I did make a remote appearance by Skype, as a matter of fact. And has said my say, just as I have all along, the way we're talking about now. From what little I know, I don't consider myself a real expert in this area at all, but I did have had certain experiences that I do talk about, and I've told you about all I know in this.
Have you, well, first of all, I'm assuming that there are other, not just pilots, but also astronauts who have had experiences that they haven't felt comfortable coming forth with. Is that true?
Well, some may have had. I cannot speak to all of that because I may not know. But, for example, Gordon Cooper, when he was on duty out at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, had I don't mean that, Edward, at Edwards Air Force Base, had a UFO event where one seemed to have landed on the field premises there, and he took, had pictures taken of it and sent the pictures off to headquarters and never heard from them again. And there are those types of events that happen somewhere along the chain that gets hushed up and shut up and go into some deep, dark hole and never be heard from again.
Do you think that at some point your fellow astronauts will feel courageous enough to step forward? Seems to me that this kind of a thing takes people stepping forward in numbers. You know, it takes a few courageous leaders like yourself, and it takes also then a lot of people who feel comfortable coming forward with a group.
It does, but it also, you got to have experiences, and it's not clear how many have really had valid experiences. For example, I was on, testified with a Air Force officer who was on duty in England and vectored to chase a UFO, which he could not catch, and he fired missiles at it, which did not hit. But he told that story. He told that story publicly. And I'm sure there are other stories like that. I certainly don't know them all. And I only know a few. But the biggest stories have to do, as you touched on earlier in our conversation, over the missile sites that we had in the northern part of the United States for back during the Cold War. And many, many times, and many officers involved with those particular missile sites spoke of their missiles being disabled in the presence of UFOs coming over and making it quite clear that they were hovering over there, and that suddenly the missiles go out of commission. And that has happened upon many, many occasions, and those officers have spoken about it.
Okay, yeah. And those aren't ours. Those aren't our craft, I'm assuming. We don't have that capability?
Not that I know of.
or as Colonel Alexander told me on this show, that we might have the capability to turn the stuff off. We don't have the capability to turn it back on again.
I think that may be true, too.
Okay. All right. We've got to take another quick break. Everybody stay with us. You're listening to Hot Leads, Cold Cases. My guest tonight is Dr. Edgar Mitchell.
Enlighten, empower, enrich. This is CBS Radio's The New Sky. New horizons, no boundaries.
Thank you.
CBS Radio's The New Sky. The Sky.
We're back. This is Hot Leads and Cold Cases with Nancy Duterte. Call Nancy Duterte now.
248-545-7685.
Welcome back, everybody. You're listening to Hot Leads, Cold Cases. My guest tonight is Dr. Edgar Mitchell. And we were talking about sort of the trends and problems of disclosure of UFOs and extraterrestrials. I'm actually curious, just before we move on, what convinced you about the existence of extraterrestrials?
You're talking... Well, for me, it's a preponderance of evidence going back through history. In particular, the very powerful investigators, both in Europe, South America, and here in the United States, who have devoted a number of years, particularly since the Roswell incident, that kind of got things going here, that have, and then the military officers who reported observations of UFOs over our satellite, rather over our missile sites in the northern part of the United States. That's pretty heavy evidence. And so you listen to that, and then you start to get some of the other people and listen to what they've encountered, and also pilots who have encountered them over the years. As a matter of fact, since I was in the Korean War myself, many pilots, aviation, airline pilots and military pilots were reporting UFO encounters, and whenever they reported it, they were descended upon by the intelligence people and told to hush up about it, to the point that by the mid-late 50s and 60s, officers just weren't reporting it anymore. They were tired of being hassled about it.
But I'm saying not just UFOs, I'm saying aliens, extraterrestrials. I think you've talked about the little grays. I mean, I think everybody knows about little grays. But people have talked about many, many different species, and I'm wondering, you know, what's convinced you that there are beings?
I can only speak to, in that particular, those particular instances, to the various investigators who have spent more time at it than I have. I've not considered UFOs and aliens my primary area of research, but I do know many of the very significant U.S. people and European people on a first name basis who have done that. And so I've read their literature, and yes, as far as I can tell, several species, maybe up to four different species, appear having different appearances. But since I don't have any personal experience, I can't speak to that very well.
So you wouldn't agree with, I think it was Clifford Stone who said there were something like, I don't know, it was 57 or 60 different species that he had categorized.
I could not speak to that at all.
And didn't you know somebody personally who was involved in the transport of the tiny coffins from Roswell to Wright-Patterson Air Force Base?
No, the people that I knew were preceding that. When I was out lecturing in my hometown, my home territory near Roswell and in environments, since I grew up in that area, after I got... came back to the moon and went out to renew acquaintances and give a couple of lectures. Some of the descendants of the Roswell people, for example, the undertaker that provided coffins, mm-hmm. his family came forward and wanted to tell their story. Mm-hmm. And it was the story, of course, that their ancestor, I can't remember if it was a father or grandfather, but father, I believe, was the undertaker that provided coffins to the Air Force. And then there was another gentleman who was a descendant of a sheriff's department, a trooper, who had been responsible for helping control the traffic around the so-called crash site. And he had his story to tell. And then we also had a personal friend of our family who was not involved, but who was an office mate of some of the officers that had been involved. And he said, yes, that's what was the talk. That was the true that as far as he knew, that was a true, those were true stories that had happened at the Walker Air Force Base in Roswell.
And your understanding of extraterrestrials or aliens, I've heard you say this publicly also, is that you believe that they're not hostile, that they are, whether they're here to help may be a different issue, but you don't believe that they're here to harm.
Well, if they were here to really harm us, they could have done so. Clearly, their technologies are much more advanced than we're, than ours are. And, for example, if the Phoenix Lights or any of the vehicle or any of the very large vehicles that have been reported or those over the missile silos really wanted to harm us other than keep us from harming ourselves and going to war, they could have done that. And so it doesn't appear that the evidence supports the fact that they're really hostile toward us.
Is there evidence to support that we are hostile towards them and that we're shooting down their craft?
Well, one should say that that would be elements of hostility, yes, to shoot down their craft. But I haven't known that to really take place. It seems that there have some instances of pursuit, but I don't know, I do not personally know before any such pursuit or a shooting incident has been successful.
Okay. Well, that's good to know. One last question on the UFO issue. I'm sure you've been over these all a million times, but of course a lot of people have talked about, and this is all sort of internet grapevine type of stuff, that the whatever the shadow control group is interested in making the extraterrestrials appear to be such bad guys that at some point they plan to stage a fake global war against them so that they can consolidate power. Is that anything you've heard?
No, I do not know of any of that. I would not find that in this setting of stories going around that you have trouble believing. I wouldn't find that too outlandish either. Whether it is true or not is quite a different matter.
Okay. Let me switch gears a little bit. I want to talk to you about some of the psychic experiments that you have worked on over the years. And, of course, I would love to talk to you about the secret. And that's your chair. I'm going to let our listeners know that's nothing wild. That's just your chair. You ran a sort of secret ESP test while you were on board your Apollo 14 mission.
And, wait, say that again, please.
I was just sort of describing what you were doing. You did run. You run a, or secretly conducted an ESP or telepathy test while you were on board the Apollo 14 mission, and that before you went to sleep at night, you apparently concentrated on sending just one image from Dr. J.B. Ryan's Zener cards, which are the famous five cards that have simple shapes on them, to, I believe it was four of your friends on planet Earth, is that right?
Yes. Well, it was a full-blown experiment like Dr. Ryan had conducted in the laboratory. I set it up beforehand so that I had cards on my knee board that had room for a full set of experiments. And I guess I did that four different times while I was in flight. And it wasn't really secreted after the fact. It was became well-known. Mm-hmm. But at the time, yes, there were two physicians that were involved, medical doctors that were close friends, became close friends and were very interested in this, and a couple other people who were also very interested. And let's just, long story short, the results we got were checked by Dr. Ryan and another eminent parapsychologist, and our results were as good as anything they got in the laboratory when the researchers were just across in a different part of the building from each other. In other words, it was very, very, we had very, very good results.
So I'm curious to know, because obviously you must have had some interest prior to going up, if you'd already taken the time to plan that. Had you had your own psychic types of experiences in the past?
No, I had become interested in the work of Dr. Rhine and the area of parapsychology, ESP, and so forth, consciousness studies, as it were. And I'd become interested in that. So when my friends, who were medical doctors, expressed their interest also, we kind of together cooked up this possibility of doing an experiment in space for the distances between here and the moon. And we did that, and it was set up in such a way as to be a very well-controlled scientific experiment under very well-controlled conditions and checked by independent agencies, but not ourselves, because we could see it too, and we had gotten very good results.
Were the four people that you selected, I'm assuming if they were physicians, they were probably, you know, who were left-brained, analytic type of non-psychic people. Is that true?
Two of them were, yes.
Okay.
Two of them were medical doctors. One of them was a noted psychic. And the fourth one, I'm trying to remember what his background was, but he wasn't a really noted psychic at all. Three of them were average people, as I say. Two of them were medical doctors, and the results were when all compared, and the results were checked. It was as good as we got, as Rhine and others got in the laboratory when the workers were just in the same building with each other.
And I think you said that the odds that they achieved were something like I don't know if it was 3,000 to 1 or 6,000 to 1.
As I remember, without getting my notes out, it's been a long time.
Okay, don't worry about that. But I did read, there's a website devoted to anybody who's skeptical about everything and anything. And they said, well, you know, your ESP stuff didn't really count because your launch was delayed 40 minutes, and therefore the timing was all off, and therefore really what they were doing was some sort of precognition and not telepathy. How would you respond to that?
True, yeah. What is it true is that we planned on doing 6 experiments each day on the way out, each day coming back. Now, my schedule was such, I only had time to do it 2 days going out and 2 days coming back. Mm-hmm. And when we compared the 6 results, which it was, did not have actual results from them, the chances the results were such that chance could have produced our results 1 out of 6,000 times experiments. But when we were narrowed it down to the 4 that I actually did, as opposed to including the 2 I didn't do, the results went up to 1 out of 13,000 experiments. So when we measured, when we worked with those where there were real results, yeah, that was as good as anybody got in the laboratories in those days.
So we have about just 15 seconds before we got to go to break, but what do you think you proved?
Beg your pardon?
What do you think you proved by that experiment?
Oh, well, I mean, what we now know from years later, studying with these sorts of phenomena, that the so-called psychic events are quantum events, and the quantum information structure is needed to explain that. We didn't know that at the time. We do now. Mm-hmm. And so a quick example is we say our intuition, which is the basis of our psychism, intuition is our sixth sense, when we really ought to call it our first sense, because it's rooted in the quantum world, which is more fundamental in nature than our sensory mechanism.
Totally agree with you. We got to take another quick break. You're listening to Hot Leads, Cold Cases. My guest tonight is Dr. Edgar Mitchell.
Enlighten, empower, enrich. This is CBS Radio's The New Sky. New horizons, no boundaries.
Slowly fading.
BS Radio's The New Sky. New horizons, no boundaries.
Back to hot leads and cold cases with Nancy Duterte.
You're hot and you're cold. Yes, and you're cold. You're in and you're out. You're up and you're down.
Call Nancy Duterte now.
248-545-SOUL.
Welcome back, everybody. You're listening to Hot Leads, Cold Cases, and my very special guest tonight is Dr. Edgar Mitchell, and we are coming into our last segment. Dr. Mitchell, another very interesting experiment that I learned about that you conducted, and I don't know what year this was. I know that you founded the Institute for Noetic Sciences in 1972, and you began your scientific studies of consciousness. I don't know if this was a part of that or something different, but I heard that you were contacted by the parapsychologist Andreja Prahorek, and he introduced you to Uri Geller, who I know quite well. And he's Uri Geller, as a lot of people know, he's very famous for his sort of strange telekinetic skills and his ability to bend spoons. And you brought him to the Stanford Research Institute for testing, the way I understand this. And you tell this most incredible story when the two of you were sitting in the SRI cafeteria and Uri was eating some ice cream. Maybe you can describe what happened from that point.
Well, that was a true story. And yes, we were in the cafeteria and we were getting ready to do experiments. I don't remember exactly what you're reaching for here. However, I'll tell the story is that what really came out of that was some psychokinetic events that Geller did, which I think the most important things is that after we did our experiments, and he validated himself as able to do that in the laboratory very, very well. And what more importantly, I think, is that he went on television a lot, and children would watch him. And I had, and they went into Mama's kitchen, got spoons, and bent them. And Mama would get all concerned and give me a call that Johnny was bending spoons because he had seen Uri Geller on television. What could I do to help her? So I would take my own spoon and go out and look at and beat little Johnny and or get one out of Mama's kitchen and let little Johnny show me what he was doing and hold it in my hand. And sure enough, there were a couple of little kids that, after watching Geller on television, proceeded to do the same thing. And, of course, we had quite a full Hal Putoff and Russell Targ and the team at SRI, Stanford Research Institute, did a large number of experiments with Uri, validating his capabilities. And I've stayed in touch with him over the years, and of course he has utilized his talents. And I'm not so sure, frankly, and this, I don't have any real evidence to back this, but Uri at one point made a claim that ETs or UFOs, alien visitors, was responsible in his early days for showing him how to do all of that.
Yeah, that's what he says. I mean, there's a whole sort of story that goes with that. And apparently witnesses who said that they saw him in a garden, a neighboring garden, and there was a craft that was above and shot down a beam of light. And after that, he would hold spoons and they would just melt in his hands.
Yeah, a lot of stories about Uri.
But the story that really got my attention was he apparently bit down on his ice cream while he was at the cafeteria, and he cried out in pain, and his lip bled a little bit, and that he had bitten on something metallic. You had asked him to see if he could materialize one of the cameras that you had left on the moon. And so apparently he was working on that mentally, but that didn't happen. And what did happen was he came up, that was a piece of a tie clip that you apparently had lost years earlier. And then you found, when you were with him in the lab, more tie clips dropped to the ground out of nowhere.
Yeah, I cannot recount that story. It's not exactly as you said it, but yes, he did recover a tie clip for me that had been lost along the way before I met him. And I still have that in my memorabilia here in my safe here in this house. But I don't remember at the moment, without going and reviewing some notes, exactly the circumstances under which that occurred. But it did take place during the luncheon at SRI, and then continued thereafter until it all completed itself. And you've touched on a bit of it when you were describing it there, but I cannot elucidate that anymore without referring to my notes.
Well, you apparently said it was even it was a broken tie clip. You got two pieces of it that matched perfectly, and then you got a tie clip that your brother had given you with a pearl on it that you had lost also.
Yes, there's a couple of stories like that, and I'm sorry, Nancy, I'd have to go back to my notes to remember that 40-year-old stuff.
Well, I have to tell you, I asked Ori about it, and I said to him, do you happen to remember that story? And he said, are you kidding me? How could I forget that story? And I said, well, what was your reaction? And he said, well, it was mind-blowing. So it was even mind-blowing for him.
Who were you asking?
Uri Geller.
Oh, you were asking Uri. Yes. Well, there's some of the details I'm missing as a reason I can't remember, as a reason I can't recount it for you.
Okay, well, even if you can't remember the exact details on it, obviously you remember that he was able to materialize objects.
Yes.
What, if anything, does that suggest to you about the ability to materialize or dematerialize things as large as a UFO?
Well, let's be careful with the words. I'm not sure dematerialize or materialize is the correct word. Obviously, in the case of these tie pins, they were teleported from some other place. In other words, they did exist. Mm-hmm. They weren't materialized. They did exist, and they were moved into our current location by a teleportation idea. And those sorts of things happen, but many of those events are so distant in the past, without reviewing notes, I can't recount them as like I might have a few years ago.
Have you ever had any other experiences of things materializing out of nowhere?
No. No, Uri's, I'm quite familiar. I'm not familiar with them. I've got to remember them. But I haven't had any like Uri's events. He was very powerful in that regard.
And the reason why I'm sort of staying on this is because...
I've got a telephone that's ringing.
Okay. Hopefully, don't pick it up yet. We only got a couple more minutes.
Was another one. I will recall. You brought it back to memory. I can't pick that up yet. Okay. It was once when I was coming back from... doing work with Uri out in SRI, I had a healer close to me back in Houston. And I went back to Houston, and he asked me where I'd been. And I told him I was in SRI with Uri and Hal Puthoff and so forth. And we were doing these experiments. And he said, oh, you want to see those sorts of experiments? Well, he did materialize another tie pin for me at that point. And I'd have to look my notes to get all the exact details here. But he was a Tibetan trained healer who was very, very gifted in the psychic world also. And he, as a healer.
Yeah, you mentioned him in your book. I think his name was, it was something like Norbu or?
Norbu Chen was his name. Yes. Yeah. Now deceased, but he was, back in those days, he was still alive.
Yeah. So something about you and tie pins that just seems cosmic.
Yeah. they were easy objects to play with.
I've had things materialize out of thin air, and I certainly know other people have had that experience too. I'm just wondering, you from your perspective as a scientist, do you have any thoughts or feelings or beliefs about that? We've got about 30 seconds.
I do not think you're actually materializing things. You are teleporting something. I haven't had any instances of something being materialized that didn't exist, didn't pre-exist in some shape. So I have to be I try to be very specific and careful about the words I use. But yes, teleporting things and moving them around from one place to another, these fellows who are gifted in this seem to have have had quite a capability there.
Are we as a human race going to have that capability pretty soon?
Well, I think we always have. We just haven't learned to develop it.
Okay.
It's all a part of the way of being.
Fair enough. Let me, because unfortunately we are pretty much out of time here, if people want to get a hold of you, Dr. Mitchell, or they want to find out more about the Institute of Noetic Sciences, or if they want to get a hold of your books, how would they do that?
Well, the Institute of Noetic Sciences would be best to go right onto the ION's website, noetic.org, and take a look there. My own website is edmitchellapollo14.com, getting my books and getting in touch with me could be done that way.
Terrific. And I do absolutely recommend The Way of the Explorer. It's a great book, and it really gives you the experience as if, you know, we could all be on the moon with you. It's a fantastic book. Thank you so much for being with us.
You bet. Goodbye.